We'll be talking about the sinking of a famous ship early in the 20th century in this hour, and not the Titanic this time. It was only 3 years after the Titanic went down with great loss of life that the British ship Lusitania sank with great loss of life after being torpedoed by a German submarine in the First World War. That was in 1915. The tale has been retold by our guest 100 years later in the book Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. Eric Larson, the author, has been racking up bestsellers in recent years, including The Devil in the White City and In the Garden of Beasts. Dead Wake's initial release put it on the New York Times bestseller list as well, including a week at number one. It is now out in paperback. Eric Larson, thanks so much for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
This is by no means the first book written about the Lusitania. What got you interested in writing about it?
Well, it's definitely not the first book written, but the reason I decided to actually take it on was because I saw an opportunity, I felt, to add something fresh to the historiography of the ship. And that is, you know, when I started to do some preliminary reading, and I've always been interested in maritime history, and Lusitania has always sort of been there and often my peripheral vision, you know. But when I started reading about it, I was immediately intrigued by things that, as I, you know, I found myself saying often, "Wow, I didn't know any of this." But really, what happened, what made me decide to do it, was when I went down to a sort of an exploratory visit to an archive at the Hoover Institution, a relatively modest Lusitania archive there, and I suddenly realized that you know, none of the works that I had read seemed, in my view, to have leveraged the really rich, deep reservoir of archival materials available on the subject. I just realized, you know, I can put on my Alfred Hitchcock hat and actually write like truly a nonfiction suspense maritime thriller on the subject, and that's what I set out to do.
It really does lend itself to that, and I want to talk about, you mentioned going to the archive at the Hoover Institution. Yep. There was also some access you got at the University of Liverpool that apparently was instrumental.
Yes, that was a very important thing. So I first of all, the University of Liverpool in England holds all of the Cunard historical archives. You know, the current Cunard company doesn't hold them. The university does. Now, I knew from my research that photographs had been taken of the dead, a number of the dead from the Lusitania, those who had not been identified. And Cunard meticulously cataloged all the belongings of these people and also photographed them in the hopes that eventually somebody would identify them. So I knew that these photographs existed, and I discovered that they were in fact at the University of Liverpool. However, access was a little bit tricky. I asked the library first. I said, you know, can I see these? And they said no, that they had decided to classify these as strictly private to protect the privacy of the dead, you know. And I said, well, you know, do you think you could take my request a little bit higher up the chain? I mean, I came all this way, and I think it would be really valuable. Next day I came in, and they said, well, we're going to let you look at them, but you can't reproduce them. You can't photograph them with your digital camera or anything like that, but you can just look at them. And so I said, great, you know, but what caused the change of heart? And they said, well, turns out the director was a big fan of your book, Devil in the White City. One of the few times that a book of mine has gotten me access anywhere.
That's great that you got the access. So yeah.
But these were very, very, these were very powerful, and the reason I felt it was very, very important to see these is because, you know, you can know that an event happened, right? You can know it in your heart and in your mind, but until you see these photographs, until you see the dead, and you just don't really get it, you know, and suddenly you see these things and these images, and you do. I mean, there they are. These bodies were recovered soon after the sinking of the Lusitania, and you know, they're wearing the clothes that they wore aboard ship. They look as if they could get up and just walk out of that morgue, but of course they can't. And it's just really was a very important thing to be able to see.
That was just one part of the research. I mean, how much time did you spend on letters and telegrams and all the other things that enabled you to put together a good narrative aboard the ship?
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, the research is half the fun. I mean, typically my books take about 4 years, half is writing, half is research, although there's always some overlap in the middle. The research I love. I do my own research. I don't share easily, so I do my own research. To me, it's a lot of fun. I get to go places and experience life in those places as well as going into the archives. But you know, it's great fun. I went to the Archives of the UK, which is really terrific. That's at Kew, and to the University of Liverpool and Cambridge, and also you know, in the United States, Library of Congress, of course, and the National Archives and other archives and miscellaneous archives. And it was, you know, it's really fun. Very intense. I was able to spend, you know, like I say, 2 full years. But I have the luxury of being able to do this full time, so it was a real pleasure.
Let's get a larger context here, if we would, Eric Larson. This was 3 years after the sinking of the Titanic. Even without the threat of submarines, had the view of shipping changed?
No, the Titanic. Well, I mean, it hadn't changed for the better or the worse. I mean, after the Titanic, I mean, you know, ships kept getting bigger and more luxurious. The difference was that they had plenty of lifeboats, you know. That was the problem with the Titanic. It simply did not have enough lifeboat capacity for all passengers. That changed immediately afterwards, and that was never a problem again. And indeed, the Lusitania had much more lifeboat capacity than passengers, although access to those lifeboats proved to be somewhat problematic, but you know, ships were still, that was the way to go, and there was no alternative, and they were getting more and more luxurious and bigger until the war started, and then you know, a lot of these ships actually got taken out of service. The British turned a number of really posh ocean liners into troop ships and hospital ships. The Germans left many of their crack liners interned in neutral ports because they did not want the British to seize them at sea and turn them into armed naval cruisers to use against the British Navy. So the Lusitania was the biggest, best, fastest show in service at that time.
Because a lot of other ships had been taken out for for other uses.
Exactly.
The book is called Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. Eric Larson is its author and our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. The book is out on paperback as of last week. You can join us on the exchange when we come back, but you can also take part in our fund drive as we go to the break. Let me remind you, we are on day 3 of an 8-day spring fund drive looking for your pledge of support. That goes to 888-552-6191. Or you can pledge yourself online at ijpr.org. Back with Eric Larson and Dead Wake and your phone calls and emails in a minute 15. Back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Eric Larson. He is the author of Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania, about the sinking of the Lusitania with the loss of nearly 1,200 lives in 1915 by a German submarine in World War I. The book is now out in paperback. You can join us as we talk about all the process that Eric Larson went through to put the book together and the many things he found out. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone. By email, it's jx@jeffnet.org. So, Eric, how widespread was the discussion of the threat of German submarines at that time and even on board the ship itself?
Well, you know, submarine warfare had drawn the attention of travelers and you know, shipping companies around the world because, you know, the attacks on civilian vessels, cargo ships and otherwise, you know, these so-called acts of frightfulness were really a new phenomenon. What was particularly interesting in the case of the Lusitania episode was that on the day of the ship's departure, that very morning in New York, May 1, 1915, Saturday morning, the German embassy had placed a notice in a variety of New York newspapers explicitly warning passengers from sailing on vessels that were going to the British Isles because they would be entering a so-called war zone and they would be doing so at their own risk. This was not, contrary to subsequent argument, this was not an announcement aimed specifically at Lusitania. It was sheer coincidence that it ran that same day, though many thought it might have been aimed at the Lusitania. But this was one more element that made submarine warfare against shipping front and center in terms of the national awareness.
So you mentioned that it had been there had been attacks on commercial ships already. Had there been attacks on ships that were known primarily as passenger conveyances?
There were attacks on ships that were primarily passenger ships. There were these hybrid vessels that had passengers and cargo. The salient point was that the Germans had begun attacking civilian vessels, whether they were cargo carrying or not, and they'd begun attacking them without warning.
And so, what was the attitude of Cunard and the ship's crew, for that matter, about their any concerns they might have known about this? The captain did mention it on the crossing. You bring up.
Yeah, well, you know, Cunard and the crew and certainly Captain Turner. They all kind of embraced the thinking of the time, which was that Lusitania was so big and so fast that no submarine could catch it, let alone sink it. You know, this was a big part of the belief. But there was also a belief still, even though there had been attacks on civilian vessels, there was still a prevalent belief that even Germany, which had sort of sacrificed a lot of the restraints on warfare with its attacks on civilians in Belgium and so forth, that even Germany would not seek to sink so prestigious and a civilian liner fully loaded with passengers. So those were two components that I think allowed Cunard and the captain and the crew to essentially sail without really thinking much about what they were doing.
So let's come back to some basics about the ship itself. I mean, in a time of swanky ships, how well-appointed was the Lusitania?
Well, Lusitania was, again, in terms of vessels in service at the time, it was the swankest, the most luxurious afloat. I mean, it had, for example, a first-class stateroom might have an actual wood-burning fireplace. You know, it was that kind of a ship. It was very, very luxurious, and actually, all the classes were more luxurious, shall we say, than on other ships. Second class was considered to be the equivalent of first on other ships, and third class, immigrant class, was considered even very nice, not up to the level of second or first, but very nice because there was a lot of competition for the so-called immigrant trade, immigrant class. And that meant that those travelers had, reasonably nice accommodations, good hearty food. So that was another aspect of the voyage.
This is the Jefferson Exchange. Our guest is Eric Larson, the author of Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. You mentioned already this is a very large ship, but to give an idea of how large, your accounting of its appetite for coal is a great indication. This was a tremendous burner of coal.
Tremendous burner of coal. The funny thing about the Lusitania is that, outwardly, if you looked at it while it was sailing across the ocean, or while even it was at its moorage in New York, you saw this really sleek, stunning, immense vessel. Just the lines of this ship were just very, very appealing. I mean, even standing still, it looked like it was like racing through the sea. But what this masked also, though, was the fact that it was a very, very labor-intensive ship and ran on coal-fired boilers, and that deep within the ship, it was like going back in time to some kind of like weird hellish dungeon, where guys shovel coal full time, day in, day out, to power this thing. So it was this mix of just absolutely sleek and gorgeous, and this kind of primitive, it was sort of the final days of well, not the final days, but the last days when liners were powered by these gigantic boiler rooms.
There's a great little passage though where you indicate that try as they might to indicate how posh things were. Above decks, that there was coal dust all over the ship at times.
Yeah.
I mean, it was a constant effort to try to keep it away.
Yeah, well, that was one of the problems when loading the ship with coal. Coal dust is it's notoriously a fine, sifty kind of thing, and also dangerous. I mean, it can blow up, in the right circumstances, but things have to be just right for that to happen. But anyway, so one of the problems for the ship was that when after the coal was loaded, this dust would migrate everywhere, and you know the cabin crews had to spend a lot of time cleaning the bright work, you know, polishing things and removing the dust from plates and, you know, tabletops and so forth before the passengers could come aboard.
So in order for Cunard to be able to build the Lusitania and its sister ship, the Mauritania, what sorts of things did the British Admiralty require?
Well, yeah, that's part of the story here, is that the Lusitania and the Mauritania sister ships were built because of a deal that Cunard cut with the Admiralty. The Admiralty gave Cunard a very cheap loan to build these giant ships on condition that certain things happen. One was the ships had to be very, very fast, because these were going to be the Royal Mail carriers. They had to be very fast, 25 knots or better. They also had to have, they had to have at least 3/4 of their officers and crew had to be British citizens. And also they had to be configured a certain way, because one aspect of the Admiralty deal was that, you know, if war were to arrive of any kind, and this was well before World War I when this was agreed to, if any kind of war were to arrive, that the Admiralty would be able to commandeer these ships and turn them into whatever for military use. And what they envisioned at the time was that they would be turned into so-called armed naval cruisers, that is, civilian liners that would be heavily armed with naval guns and then would be sent out to act as commerce raiders against whatever enemy Britain had at the time. Interestingly, there were specifications for the Lusitania to be armed with, I think it was 12 rather large naval guns. The guns were never installed, although the holding down rings, that is the brackets that would hold the guns, were in fact installed aboard Lusitania. But that gave rise forever afterwards to a conspiracy theory that said that, you know, when it was sunk, that it was armed with these guns, but in fact it was not.
And that was going to be the next question, so I'm glad you anticipated that. I'm sure you read it a lot. The book is called Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. Eric Larson wrote it. It's now out in paperback. You can join us on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about this famous ship and its famous final moments. 800-838-3760 to join us by phone, by email, jx@jeffnet.org. Let's bring some personalities in here. Captain William Thomas Turner, apparently an excellent sailor. How were his people skills, though?
Yeah, Captain Turner. I like Captain Turner quite a bit. I mean, Captain Turner. First of all, he exuded competence and capability. He was a mariner of the old school, you know. I think if I had encountered him on the bridge of the Lusitania on the day of departure, I would have felt really reassured. You know, it's kind of like you know. I don't know about you, but I'm a lousy flyer. And one thing that helps me kind of reassure me is if I hear the captain's voice and it's a good, calm, you know, Robert Stack kind of voice, you know, not like Woody Allen or something. You know? I think Turner fell into that category. He just exuded a sense of competence, but he was not socially adept. He did not care for the social aspects of captaincy. In fact, he once referred to passengers of the ships that he piloted for the that he captained for Cunard. He once referred to them to his companion and housekeeper. He referred to them as bloody monkeys, and he was sufficiently unwilling to engage in the social niceties of sea travel that there was a essentially a secondary captain assigned to the ships to handle the social side. He was, as Turner said, more clubbable, and so he was the staff captain.
There's a bit of a twist here that Captain Turner, while he was in New York waiting to sail back to Liverpool, gave a deposition. What was going on there?
Yeah, that was another one of the little weird things. It was the Friday, actually, before the Lusitania departed. Turner went to a law firm in Lower Manhattan, and where he did a deposition in the Titanic sinking, because at that point there was the Cunard limitation of liability hearing or trial. White Star. White Star was trying to limit its exposure to lawsuits. This is a limitation of liability proceeding. and that was being held in New York. And Turner was brought in to testify, to testify, for example, on you know how unwise it was that the Titanic had sped at high speed through an ice field, things like that.
Interesting. We have a call here from Mark in Reading. Welcome to the Jefferson Exchange with Eric Larson, the author of Dead Wake.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Does your book mention Albert Hubbard, an American philosopher who died on the Lusitania?
And it does. It does. Yeah.
My second question is, do are the stories that the Lusitania was carrying large quantities of so-called sporting ammunition, is that still in effect?
All right, thanks for this, Marty.
Yeah. The munitions question. The Lusitania was carrying tons and tons and tons of small arms. I hadn't heard it called sporting ammunition, but it was carrying tons and tons and tons of small arms ammunition, Remington ammunition to be specific, and also tons of relatively inert shrapnel shells. These, however, had nothing to do with the actual what actually happened as the ship was hit by the torpedo and sank. What has been long speculated about in by conspiracy theorists and so forth is that there may have been other things aboard. Lusitania was very open. Cunard was very open about the fact of the small arms ammunition and the shrapnel shells because, you know, a couple of days after the ship left New York, Cunard released the entire manifest and this listed all the ammunition. This was perfectly legal under U.S. neutrality laws. But the question has long been posed, well, what else was aboard? Was there some mysterious cache of high explosives? For example, one author proposed that, you know, there was this mysterious shipment of oysters aboard, oysters in May, you know, a month without an R. You know, what was going on there? Were these actually barrels full of high explosives? You know, we'll never know. We'll never know if, in fact, there were other munitions aboard. What we do know, I think, beyond doubt, is that if there were, they had nothing to do with the sinking. The sinking was just this fluky thing that happened.
Tell us a bit about that philosopher that Mark asked about.
Yeah, it was Albert Hubbard. Hubbard was a very interesting character, very charismatic guy. He was a founder of a group called the Roycrofters in upstate New York, the sort of an arts and crafts movement. Just a very, very charismatic speaker as well. He had written a very important sort of not self-help but maybe let's call it motivational essay called A Message to Garcia that had become the thing for businesses to give to new employees and so forth. And unfortunately, he didn't make it.
Hmm. There are other personalities mentioned here who were not directly connected to the ship. For example, America's First Lady and her death comes in here. How relevant is that to the Lusitania story?
Well, you know, in my view, very relevant because, you know, she died in August of 1914, contemporaneously with the start of World War One, and she really left, you know, President Wilson was just haunted by her death, and he was just deeply grieving, and you know, everywhere he went in the White House, there's just reminders of this long marriage to his dead wife, and it was a terrible time for him. You know, meanwhile, you know, the world is going to hell. But then one day he spies this beautiful widow, Edith Bowling Galt. And you know, one thing leads to another. He falls absolutely in love with her and begins writing her these passionate, passionate love letters, which I encountered in the Library of Congress. He starts writing these letters to her. Even as the Lusitania is crossing the Atlantic, he is just totally infatuated with this woman. And I think that context is everything. It's so important, I think, to know that Wilson, who is going to be called upon to respond, you know, to craft America's response to the sinking, that he is so in love, he is so distracted. Now he's still doing his job, but I just think it's very important to know all that.
It's a really interesting detail. Absolutely, Arthur Conan Doyle, the creator of Sherlock Holmes, makes a cameo in here as well. How did he see the future, in a sense?
Well, he does because interestingly, he had written a story well before World War One, in which he unlike anybody else, I mean, he understood, and this was not a Sherlock Holmes story. He saw what many did not, which was how submarines were going to change warfare, naval warfare forever. He speculated in this book that a small number of submarines deployed by an unnamed northern European country, small northern European country, could bring the mighty British Navy and Britain to its knees just by the way submarines operated. And that was fascinating because certainly his vision played out.
Absolutely. You call the ship that sank the Lusitania the happiest U-boat. Why does it get that title?
The happiest U-boat. I didn't call it that. Others called it that. But yeah, it was mainly because the captain, who when I started doing the research, I was kind of hoping that he would be some out and out villain like a Max von Sydow character from an old film, with a scar down the side of his face or something. But in fact, what I got was this 30-year-old guy, Walther Schwieger. 30-year-old guy, handsome, blue eyes, nice guy, warm, humane, loved by his crew, and that's why somebody I believe referred to it as the happiest U-boat. U-boats in particular, the climate aboard is set exactly by the nature of the captain.
And we'll learn more about the insides of the U-boats when we come back to talk to Eric Larson about his book, Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania. Also want to remind you as we head for the break that it is pledge time on Jefferson Public Radio. Just a couple seconds here to remind you that we're looking for your pledges of support. We're almost at $37,000 on our way to what we hope is a $185,000 achievement of goal by the time all is said and done. Your pledges of support are welcome at 888-552-6191 or online at ijpr.org. Back to finish up with Eric Larson in a minute 10. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is Eric Larson, the author of Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania, out in paperback as of this month, anyway. We're talking about the loss of life. 1,200 people nearly died on the Lusitania when a German torpedo from a submarine took it out in 1915. So many other details that Eric Larson brings to the fore in a book that is really literary nonfiction. Join us on the exchange with questions and comments about this series of incidents and events all interlocked here. 800-838-3760 by phone, by email jx@jeffnet.org. So we met the captain, as you pointed out, was not some mustache-twirling villain, was a younger man than Captain Turner. Aboard the Lusitania, Walther Schwieger was his name. Certainly a very ambitious fellow, but ran a fairly happy submarine by all accounts of it. But boy, submarines themselves sound like fairly horrible places to work in that day.
Oh, they were terrible places to work. I mean, picture this cramped cylinder with 36 guys packed in there who never changed their clothes because what's the point? You had to be ready at all times, And here you are in this cylinder, which when it's underwater, strangely enough, submarines, despite what we know today, they weren't really built for spending a whole lot of time underwater. That was one of the things that I found very interesting. And when they had to spend longer than they're designed in time underwater, they could become really inhospitable places in terms of interior climate, like temperatures up to 100 degrees, the walls with condensation. It was just perpetually drippy and humid. They just sound like terrible places to be.
God, they really do. So so different places from what the surface ships were like in the German Navy, and then detached from the German Navy in a sense. What was the communication situation with the U-boat?
That was another aspect that was interesting. The reality of U-boats was that while they were in wireless communication with their bases, they could the bases could have some authority over what the submarines did. But submarines, when they went out on patrol, once they left that wireless range, once they're out of wireless range, the thing that characterized them was that these young commanders, you know, 28-year-old, 29, 30, these young commanders had full authority to determine, you know, what they were going to do next. Unlike surface warships, which were in constant surveillance by commanders and so forth, these guys had the ultimate power as members actually of the German political hierarchy feared. They had the power to cause an incident that would bring America into the war with catastrophic result. So yeah, once they're out of wireless contact, it was their judgment that governed.
So was Schwieger working within the directives as he understood them, or was he working toward the edges of them? I mean, how would you characterize that?
Well, let's put it this way. When he, on his way back, when he sent a wireless message, which was intercepted by the British, who were reading all the German Navy's wireless messages at this point, when he sent a wireless message announcing that he had sunk the Lusitania, not just sank it with one torpedo, promptly received a reply of congratulations from his superiors, not just congratulations, but, you know, in acknowledging this tremendous feat that this guy had pulled off. So that was before the world erupted in horror at what Schwieger had done.
How sophisticated was intelligence gathering in 1915? You mentioned that they intercepted everything.
Yeah, well, in this case, it was quite sophisticated. What had happened is there was this entity within the Admiralty, which, again, was the administrative body that ran the Royal Navy. There was this entity within the Admiralty called Room 40, which was set up to take advantage of essentially three miraculous things that happened early in the war, which was when Britain recovered on three different occasions the three most important code books governing German naval communications. Set up Room 40 to learn to decipher and decode all German wireless messages that have been intercepted by British coastal intercept towers. And so this is very, very powerful intelligence. They were essentially reading everything that the German Navy was telling its ships and vice versa. And in fact, this allowed Room 40 to track the travels and careers of various individual submarines and submarine commanders, which they did.
But as we learned with the recent movie about Alan Turing, you can't really use all the intelligence you get, because then they know that you've got all the intelligence and they can change their codes and everything.
That's the catch-22. So you know all this stuff, but you have to be very careful about what intelligence you act on. Because if you act on it all, then they're going to get wise and they're going to change their codes, and that's the end of the secret access. And that whole concept plays into this Lusitania saga. You know, it's interesting that the folks in Room 40, you know, followed this particular submarine U-20. Really, for its first 24 hours, followed it very precisely, because the wireless man aboard U-20. Nobody's quite sure why he did this, but he transmitted some, I believe it was 14 position reports during those first 24 hours, you know, right down to the precise longitude latitude. So the Admiralty knew exactly where, you know, what path the submarine was taking for the first 24 hours. It also knew exactly where it was assigned to patrol, which was right off the mouth of the Mersey River at Liverpool, which is where all the Cunard civilian liners traveled.
So there's always, you mentioned the conspiracy that existed for a long time about whether there were, in fact, some serious armaments aboard the Lusitania. You said there were small arms fire. But the other conspiracy that seems to arise out of situations like this, and I'm kind of pulling this out of the air myself, but the suggestion that powers that be sometimes let big incidents happen, like Pearl Harbor, as has often been charged with FDR, to get the kind of inflammation that will then lead to the entrance of a country into war. You find anything to that?
Well, I see that, and that's one of the lingering questions of the whole Lusitania saga, and that is why, given everything that the Admiralty knew, why was the Lusitania allowed to proceed all by itself into the Irish Sea that day? Why was it not assigned to a safer route which had just opened? Why was it not given a destroyer escort? It's all very suspicious. Now, so, but what the way I looked at it in terms of my book was, my research was, you know, I was going to be very wary about, you know, falling into conspiracy theories. So here's my approach to this. If you look at all the circumstantial evidence on one side of the ledger, yes, it's damning. You know, you do wonder, why was nothing done to save the Lusitania? But if you presented all that material to a court of law, you know, I don't think you would get a guilty verdict, you know, because there's no smoking memo. There's no concrete thing that says that the Admiralty was setting up the Lusitania. On the other hand, there's so much information, there's so much circumstantial evidence that you can't ignore it either. So the way I deal with it is I hang this on a prominent British historian of naval intelligence, a former member of naval intelligence, a self-professed lover of the Royal Navy, who, when he wrote about this some years ago, he decided that the reason the Lusitania was left unprotected was because it was a screw-up. It was, as he put it, a monumental cock-up. But later in life, after other things came forward, and after he thought about it, and other evidence appeared, he changed his mind. And there is an interesting interview on file at the Imperial War Museum in London, where he says that he decided later in life that there had been a plot. There had been a plot to set up Lusitania, but he didn't know who had done the plotting, who had set it up, who had engineered it. But he believed that there was a plot because nothing else explained the circumstances of the day.
So it went from cock-up to actual agency in some cases.
To plot, yes, to actual agency, yeah.
So the account of being on board the Lusitania after the torpedo hits, the detail is excruciating. How were you able to produce that?
Oh, because it's available. I mean, you know, one of the things that I really wanted to do was try to put people as vividly as possible aboard the Lusitania. You know, even though 1,200 people died, there were, of course, many survivors, and there were proceedings where people gave depositions. People who went through this wrote letters, you know, describing their experience. They left accounts. They left books. And when you read through these things very closely, you pick up all kinds of really interesting, precise details about what life was like aboard the ship, and what it was like as this last moment arrived.
Of all the materials you read, all the accounts from people who were on board that ship, is there one person's view who sticks with you that sticks with you more than any other?
Well, you know, my favorite character is my favorite character. My favorite account was by this young guy, Dwight Harris, who was a New Yorker, who was on his way to Britain to get engaged, and he had his ring with him tied around his neck and some other jewelry and stuff. He's young and very enthusiastic and but also prudent. I mean, before the ship set sail, he went to the John Wanamaker store the day before the ship set sail before it departed. The day before, he went to the John Wanamaker department store in New York and bought a custom life belt. He bought his own custom life belt because he was taking no chances with this vessel, you know. But anyway, what I loved about this was that after, you know, he survived, and afterwards he wrote this long letter to his mother with all kinds of details about the voyage, about his experience, you know, in the water and afterwards and so forth. And the thing that I love most about the letter is that he was so enthusiastic. You know, he was just so glad to have survived, but also so glad to have been part of this huge historical event. Like, every sentence has multiple exclamation points, you know.
That sounds great. Dwight Harris, one of the 767 people who survived the sinking of the Lusitania, where 1,198 died, relayed very carefully in the book Dead Wake, The Last Crossing of the Lusitania by Eric Larson, now out in paperback. Eric, very much a pleasure. Thanks for joining us today on The Exchange.
Thank you for having me. Thanks.
All right. Take care.